November 1st, City Community Dialogue, continuation of the housing issue in San Diego.
Another minute or two, look over the minutes. From the last meeting, please. Anyone who does not have the minutes? Corrections, modifications. If not, we don't take formal action on this, Mr. Bullard, because they're not the official minutes. We simply accept these with correction. Last time, 2 weeks ago, we were dealing with the matter of housing and had presentations from several individual groups, representatives and individuals here, and they brought the problem to us, and we discussed that part of it. Today, we wanted to pick up from there, and some were here last time and didn't have a chance to make any presentation or response. And they've been asked to return, and here are some of the ones, those invited to attend today. The Apartment and Rental Owners Association, Mr. Lombardi, San Diego Realty Board, Mr. Tag Worker, FHA, Mr. Cotton, who's at the table here already, Urban Coalition Housing Task Force Chairman, Mrs. Grace Ridoff, FECC, also here, Mr. Kimball Moore, Community Development Department of the City here, Mr. Galindo from HUD, the original office in L.A., Councilman Harry Scheidel, Chairman of the City Council Housing Task Force, and the Board of Supervisors and others. Some obviously could not attend. Mr. Scheidel indicated he was unable to attend because he had a prior engagement. Supervisor Cousins will be unable to attend because of a prior engagement. Mrs. Cobb, Councilwoman Cobb, is here. Councilman Schaefer indicated he had a series of speaking engagements this morning. And when I looked over this letter he sent, he started out at 7:30 at Sears in Chula Vista, 9 o'clock, 9:30, and he went on and on. As he says, this is his last hurrah this morning for his election. Others indicated they could or would not be here. Mr. Galindo, for example, is on vacation at his office.
I'm representing Mr. Galindo.
All right. Thank you very much. You tell us who you are for Mr. Galindo? You're on vacation, huh?
Yes. I'm Philip Rask, representing Mr. Galindo from the Southwest Area Office of the Department of Housing and Urban Development.
Is that R-A-S?
R-A-S-K.
Right. Thank you. Before we begin on the agenda, I'd like to make a statement and explain something. Inasmuch as the 29th is the day after Thanksgiving, that meeting obviously would not take place. So the interim committee has been working on how many meetings there should be this month and which days those meetings should be held. A poll was taken of members of the interim committee who could be reached to see about changing the dialogue date from the 15th to the 22nd, which means that if we had three meetings this month, we would meet today, the 8th and the 15th, skip the 22nd and the 29th. That's three Fridays in a row. And when we did this in the summer, as you know, it was rather rough. So we came up with this idea that we would meet today, next week, and skip a week. That's two in a row, and then come back on the 22nd, and obviously we're not having one on the 29th. That's two in a row, skip one, and come back. And that breaks it up for this month. Otherwise, we'd be meeting three times in a row. So your minutes have indicated the last two times that there would be three meetings, three Fridays in succession. I'm suggesting that you make a notation now that that's broken up, and it would be today, the 8th, and the 22nd. Yes. Now for the agenda. Yesterday we were to look at long-range governmental programs planned or in progress, short-range programs to meet the immediate needs. Rather than my summarizing what happened the last time, may I ask that some of you were here, for those who were not here, make a couple of statements about what we covered the last time, so there will be a tie-in with numbers 1 and 2 on the agenda. Volunteers?
Mr. Chairman, last week, ladies and gentlemen, we came to this organization requesting that this organization take a deep look into the very serious housing problem we have in San Diego. We brought some documented statements and proof that there is a critical situation in San Diego. We had the Navy here, we had individual families here, had several organizations who deal with housing problems, and we put it on the line. We were very successful in letting the society know just what is happening in all of San Diego, not necessarily Southeast, but all of San Diego, in terms of the shortage of housing and the exploitation of poor people by absentee landlords in our particular community. Today we plan to come back with some suggestions in terms of solutions to some of the problems that we have. Anyone else want to say something?
There were others here who participated last time. Would you like to add anything? But
I just listening, I think he covered most of the coaching points.
Scott? John, would you add a couple of things?
Well,
from last time, summarize.
Last time, as chairman of the Housing Task Force, Urban Coalition, I brought to the group a very short statement of what the Housing Task Force has done in the several months of its existence, the fact that it has inventoried about 45, prepared inventories, including about 45 different groups, associations, and agencies that are doing something about some field of housing. I brought to the attention of the group the fact that these incidents that have been discussed here are real things that are happening in San Diego and that there are real problems here. I brought to the attention of the group the action which is being taken by the City of San Diego in the formation of the Leased Housing Program, which we hope will result in the creation almost instantly of about 750 units with emphasis on large families on a subsidized rental basis, which will enable them to pay rents in most cases which they can afford to pay. I mentioned, I think, that the Housing Task Force is going to continue to explore ways in which it can spearhead the development of ideas and action by other groups, its purpose being one to push and press, so to speak, rather than itself to be an action organization. Where it finds a need in the community, it will try and find an organization that's equipped to satisfy that need, and if there is no such organization, then it will try to spearhead the formation of one which would do it. And as I mentioned to you, I will have an additional comment to make, which I didn't make last time at some appropriate time this morning.
All right. Ms. Allen, you were here last time and represented an owner side of it, and some of the problems you were facing, as well as some of the problems that the tenants were facing. Would you want to just capsule from the last time some of the points?
I'd like to make a comment that this week we've turned away 125 people looking for a place to live.
And your apartment?
If you think it's bad now, come around a couple of years from now. blocks of my property, there are 9 3-bedroom houses boarded up. They are about 6 years old.
How many?
9. I was there yesterday morning to count them. They happen to have been low, shall I say, low cost houses. They are presently appraised, as I understand, for a sale of $11,000 by FHA with $200 down. 3-bedroom houses on 25-foot lots. Nevertheless, they're boarded up. 2 or 3 months ago, I made an effort to try to buy them, just simply to rehabilitate them and make rental units out of them. Couldn't get the job.
Why not?
They wanted more money than I thought that I should have to pay for them.
To buy them?
Yes. Within 2 years, we're going to lose between 100 and 125 houses in our immediate vicinity to the highway department.
How many?
Between 100 and 125.
Within the next 2 years?
Within the next 24 months. To the highway 805. At least a third of those will go to Tijuana, which is too bad. What can we do about it? My chief theory in this whole project is, and with my cohorts in this part of town, is that we need additional housing. We don't need rent controls. We don't need subsidy rents. We need places for people to live. It's that simple. Excuse me.
Rod, what he's talking about, and before we get to solutions, so everyone will be on a common basis.
Yeah, I'll agree, Mr. Allen, that we need additional houses. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask Mr. Allen where these 9 houses are located. He said about 5 blocks from his...
On 40th and Boston.
40th and Boston.
Between 40th and 41st on Boston. Back up to Mount Fred Park.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chairman, as I said before, we do agree that we need additional houses, but we have a problem that's immediate. Right now, we have people that literally don't have any place to go. We have people who are moving into their friends' garages, and who are moving into motels. The motels are filled. Several motels in our community, which was primarily built by absentee landlords for transit purposes only, they are filled now with families, Navy families and poor families who have been evicted from various houses. So we need something right now. We talk about building houses. This is a long-range program. We're also very interested in what can we do now to curtail the kind of thing that's happening, the exploitation of people in our community. Sure, we need more houses, but we need something right now. And we'll come to that later.
Great. Well, I'd like us to move on if we can. Great. Before we do, though, Grace was here, and we had the sergeant and another representative from the Navy that also indicated their acute problem they're facing in housing. Grace, did you want to add anything at all from your angle of it?
No, obviously, the only involvement we have is if the applicant for the house or the apartment alleges racial discrimination or religious discrimination. In other words, we're the state agency that administers and implements the Fair Housing Law. And whether it is pertinent to the kinds of situations that Mr. Allen discussed or whether it isn't, I frankly don't know, but I do know that for the first 10 months of this year, we have more than twice as many cases than we had last year for the total year, and that also a higher rate of satisfactory adjustment than we've had. In other words, the problem is compounded by racial discrimination as well as the low housing market.
All right, then, as we look at it, let's see if we can get all these things in proper perspective. We had a shortage of housing, had racial discrimination compounding the problem. We have concerns now about what is being done, both by governmental agencies, our city, for example, Housing Authority, and others that we will be discussing, and what the plans are in terms of the private organizations, private individuals, etc., as they also look at this problem. And today we're going to look at possible solutions. Let's move on to what can be done, what should be done, looking at all possible areas. We are not here to attack individuals again. Just as a reminder, we're not here to attack individuals. We are to discuss the issues and raise all kinds of possible questions about what can be done, looking at it from a total perspective. Floor is open then to move on. Don.
I just have one suggestion. I looked at the agenda. One of the long-range government programs, I would like to just move that to number two, and we'll start there with the short-range program that's going to satisfy the immediate needs. I think, you know, if we're going to satisfy the immediate needs, let's make this first maybe with success.
Any objections to move it to number two first? Before we do, John, how much time do you have? When do you have to leave? An hour?
I've got to leave by 11, yes.
Okay, we'll hold off in just for a second.
Well, I think that's a good suggestion. Seems to me like the short range problem should be taken up first.
Okay, let's move on.
Because the problem in San Diego right now is a short range problem as far as the acute housing situation is concerned. It won't be a permanent problem with us forever as far as the shortage is concerned, because it never is. We swing up and down in San Diego. We've seen times when there were 30% vacancy in housing, and now a time when there's virtually none. So. May I go ahead on a brief comment here to supplement what I brought to you last meeting?
All right,
meeting?
You do that, and we'll move on to item number two, short range. Right.
Thank you. I didn't mention at the last meeting one matter which I think is very significant. The Housing Task Force Urban Coalition procured from the San Diego Housing Corporation a list of San Diego County 221D3 projects which are either completed or in process or on the drawing board, and there's a total of 2,396 such units. These are units where there is some form of regulation on the rent and priorities for families that have a need for housing. Of these 2,396 units, some are finished, some are only on the drawing board, some are under construction. But I want to bring attention to three projects right now, because the Housing Task Force found that one of these, the National City Park Apartments, which has 216 units completely occupied, has very few minority tenants. And we believe the reason for that is that there's been no particular publicity of the availability of these units. And we have arranged with the Communication Task Force of Urban Coalition to publicize this. I wanted to bring this short message to you that although 216 units are completed and occupied, and although they have 240 more units under construction now that will be finished in January of next year, and although they have a waiting list now of 200 to 250, for the total project of the 456 units, that doesn't mean that that all of 240 units are committed now, because they're not. People drop off waiting lists, they find other housing. And I would urge those who are interested in finding housing to go down and apply for apartments there. The location is 24th and D Street in National City. The phone number is 477-3114. Now, in addition, there's a 332-unit project under construction in Penasquitos Village, which will be available beginning in 1969. These are February 69. These are one and two bedroom units. And applications are now being accepted. They have only a 40-name waiting list now, so hurry out there and you can get in a good place on that waiting list for next February. The location is Highway 395 of Carmel Mountain Road. The phone number is 2793950, Mr. Ken Hawkins. And then a third one at Bay Vista, This project is under construction now. Units will be available in January. They will have two-bedroom units for 2 to 4 people, three-bedroom units for 4 to 6 people. The rent charge is set at 25% of gross income. The location is 4900 Logan Avenue. The phone number is 263-3105, and the manager's name is Mr. Ron Warren. And in this case, because it's location in southeast San Diego, it's certainly proper in order to suggest that attention be given to interesting non-minority tenants to apply for occupancy there so as to get stabilized type of occupancy and not a stratified occupancy. So I want to bring those particular things to your attention. And the reason why prospective tenants, particularly of minority race, don't hear about these units is because in this kind of a rental market, even though projects have an allowance for advertising and promoting the selling space in the ordinary sense, they don't have to. All they have to is put a sign up now renting. People see it and they fill the apartment before it's completed. And unless somebody brings it to the attention of the minority community, they don't realize that applications are being solicited. So anything that you can do to spread this word will be helpful, I think, to the program that you're interested in. And I believe that you're going to hear some good publicity on this from the Communication Task Force of the Urban Coalition.
I just had one comment to make there, Carol. When you're talking about the Bay Visitor Housing Project, what's 200, how many units?
There were
269 units at Bay Vista.
At Bay Vista?
I just wanted to say, well, there's
268, yeah.
There's now there a backlog of 1,500 people that apply for the 268 units. Or you're talking about it. What? Information about it.
Yes.
Well,
then apply in Panaskitas because there's only 40 who have applied for that, and there's 240 units coming up.
Or a Bay Visitor, there's a backlog of 1,500 people that have applied for those units. Your group.
Well, the fact of the matter is, and one reason that this is particularly important, I think, in the National City Park Department, which is 24th and D in National City, there's only a handful of minority tenants out of the first 216 units. So somehow the message isn't getting around to people in southeast San Diego that these units in National City are available.
Well, actually, Mr. Chairman, there's only a handful of minorities in many areas of San Diego, whether they are multi-dwellers or single dwellers. There's only a handful of minorities in many of your areas, such as La Jolla.
Yes, I'm not talking about the problem. I'm talking about the solution.
But I think we have to be realistic, Mr. Cotton. There's only a handful of minorities. There's many, many reasons why there's only a handful of minorities. We know, we don't want to talk about it, one, but we know why. Because we have a racist society. Not because minorities are not applying for houses or don't wish to go out and seek for houses in other areas. They do this. Seem to me trying to indicate that minorities do not do this. They do this. They do go to other areas and look for houses. We've had minorities who make a substantial amount of money attempting to purchase houses in various areas and they were unable to do this because of the relatives and everything else that wouldn't sell. Could we move on now?
Yes, Ray had it there. I think there's a question that has to be raised here about what Mr. Cotton was giving us, and I'd like to have him read off some of the rent schedules for some of the units he's talking about, because it sounds like here are lots of units that are going to be made available. I'd like him to read off the rent schedules.
So you have a copy of this, Mr. Leinbach.
Right, and I'm sending out a copy to quite a number of community groups, and maybe they've received it already. But I'd like you also to read off the rent schedules on 2 and 3 bedroom apartments in the units you mentioned.
So National City Park, 2 bedroom, 1 bath unit, renting at $110 a month. 3 bedroom apartments, renting at $128 a month. Dennisketa Village, 81 bedroom and 168 2 bedroom units. The 1 bedroom unit rent for $85 to $100 per month, and the 2 bedroom for $115 to $125 per month.
How much?
$115 to $125 for 2 bedroom. The units, which are going to be completed in February of 69. 92 1-bedroom and 242 bedrooms, and the rents there, I believe, are the same, $85 to $100 for the 1-bedroom and $115 to $125 for the 2-bedroom. At Bay Vista, the rent is set at 25% of gross monthly income, and I don't have a schedule other than that.
Or the welfare budgeted amount, and we talked about that last week. But I think, you know, if we talk about here's some housing that's available, it's not being used, and I would say that $125, $130 for a 3-bedroom place is out of the reach of the low-income large family that we're trying to talk about. So yeah, it's nice to get the information out on this, and I think we should, so that people who want to use this kind of facility and can afford these rents can. But that's not specifically the point that we're talking to this morning, I think, and we talked to a couple weeks ago, because I think this is out of reach. We have less of a housing problem than we have now, probably, if the people with the large family could afford $130 rent a month. So, you know, I think we ought to set the record straight on that, too. It's good to have the information available, but let's not delude ourselves into thinking that that these kinds of units are going to actually solve the problem.
All right, let's move on to item number 2, then, and see if we can talk about ideas about short-range programs to meet the immediate needs.
Yeah, we wanted to, Torch Organization wanted to present a list of demands which we have discussed pertaining to the discussions that we have had, the discussions we had here last Friday. They pertain both to long range and to short range solutions to these things. I think most of you have a copy of this. We determined that our number one priority was temporary housing units. This is something we need right away. This is something we need right now. We're talking about people, individuals, and families that are overcrowded, that are living in garages, as Charles said, etc. We need some housing right now. Mr. Cotton stated earlier that the city has underway the contract with the government to have 750 leased housing units. I think I got the impression from what you said, Mr. Cotton, that this was going to increase the supply to 750, and maybe I just read you wrong. That is not necessarily the case. But Torch feels that the city should provide, use these 750 units to provide an increase in supply. There are means available for this, we understand, for instance, the use of mobile homes. And we feel that the city should give serious consideration to using that 750 units to increase the supply, and not just to rehabilitate the units we already have, etc., because this is not necessarily speaking to the problem we have.
Mr. Leinbach was at the meeting of the Housing Task Force, which recommended the city that it undertake this 750-unit project for leased housing, and Mr. Leinbach voted in favor of the motion to do it, and I don't understand now
why I vote for it again, because it has the potential, and I think if it's used in this manner, it will live up to its greatest potential. And certainly it has the possibility of reducing rents that people are paying in units they're in now. But I think the best use of it would be if we used it to increase the supply. Sure, I voted for it then. I voted for it again, because it sounds like a good program. Now, we haven't seen it yet, and that's another matter. But we feel that one of the best uses of this is if they can use it to actually increase the supply, rather than just do something with what we already have. Because we're all aware that the supply is one of the central issues here, especially on a long-run basis. That affects the rent that people can pay. It's the owner's market. It affects the services that are given, evictions, and this sort of thing. So this is one of the key issues, and we're aware of this. So we think that on a short-term basis, this would be the best use of that program.
Let me ask you a question for clarification.
Right.
There are two possible uses of this, you say.
Oh, there's three, four, or five possible uses.
The two that you're contracting are what?
The possibility that you can increase the supply under this program,
as opposed to,
correct me if I'm wrong, as opposed to just leasing units that are already up, possibly allowing the owners to rehabilitate and do some fixing up.
All right, you are suggesting that the first be used.
Absolutely.
Okay, move on. Okay. That's the clarification.
Right. Some of the other things which we feel are necessary on an immediate basis is a rent control ordinance. This was mentioned by a couple of groups last week, and we're talking about here and now. We're talking about people that have to pay way out of sight rent prices. Last week, the lady was paying $100 for a one-bedroom apartment, et cetera, and it's fallen down around her ears. Right now, we need some kind of a rent control ordinance. Sure, landlords deserve a return on their property, and we're aware of this, but they don't deserve a return on their property by exploiting people that are living there. We're not necessarily talking about any kind of groups of landlords or whatnot. We're saying that they should be allowed some kind of a reasonable return. They couldn't operate if they didn't. But I think we need some kind of a control that's going to keep these people from raising rents like we had the list we showed last week, etc. We also feel that evictions are becoming much more serious problems right now, and we need some kind of a freeze on evictions so we stop having people out on the street. And via the temporary units, we try and stabilize this kind of a situation. We also feel that code enforcement is necessary. And granted, the city building inspection department is shorthand, but we need more concerted effort of code enforcement so that landlords are required to fix up these substandard units. We also have on here as a long-range basis the permanent housing. So we want to present these demands to this group for their consideration.
Mr. Chairman, in reacting to the statement, I would like to ask a question. Who would be responsible for this? Would the city council be responsible for enacting such ordinances? I'm asking for clarification, and the city attorney here, Mr. Butler, is here. And I don't know who would be responsible for this type of action that's stated here in the demands of the charge.
Well, the city council is the local housing authority, so they certainly can have something to say about the temporary units and the use of the leased housing program. We have statements from...
Well, in that light, Mr. Chairman, I would like to make a suggestion. We are all aware of this. We're sensitive with the demands, but there's nothing we can do about them here. We talked about last week that this group will present their brief to the city council for their consideration in enacting whatever ordinances are necessary to comply with the demand. I would like to make that formal motion that we, I offer that as a suggestion.
I'm going to take these then that are on this torch list here. And as you mentioned, the city attorney is here. We have Jim Goff over here.
And we have the city councilman.
We have the city councilman here. I saw FHA over here. Others here can talk through these, and if we can continue just to talk about them, he's presented 1, 2, 3, 4, as I see here, in terms of short range, and 1 permanent housing. That's the long range. Let's look at these and see then, do we need reactions from the city attorney? Earlier I saw Mr. Rask's hand up, and maybe he wants to come in here at this point.
I'm afraid I just wanted to roll back and ask him, Mr. Cotton, of the 2,400 units under D3, how many were in the rent supplement, and how many were not?
Well, only the Bay Vista project is rent supplement. The rest are BMIR.
But now, I don't know whether everyone understands all this technical housing industry language. While I do, let's
define those terms as we go along. What do you mean supplement, and what law and what law are you talking about and so forth?
The 2,400 units were apparently insured under Section 221D3 of the National Housing Act. The D3 provides for two approaches. One is a rent supplement.
What that means?
That means that the tenant pays 25% of his income toward the rent. The qualified tenant to get the subsidies or supplements would be about the same income bracket as those qualified for public housing. It means that it wouldn't matter what the rents were, because FHA would pay that portion over 25% on the qualified tenant. As far as the below market interest rate is concerned, the rule of thumb on 221D3, below market interest rate, is that it results in rents that are 25% below economic rents. I don't guarantee the accuracy, but this is the rule of thumb.
Point of clarification, Mr. Chairman. Are we talking about 2,400 units that he's talking about? Are you saying that they are rent supplement houses?
No, that's what I wanted to clarify. That he said there were 221D3, and then he did mention one project where the rent was 25% in the case of a qualified tenant.
He was just defining that for us,
so I'm just stating that we have, apparently, then, in this area, very few units insured by FHA where rent supplement is involved. What, 300 units or something?
No, let's ask over here.
Okay, let's say 300 out of 2,400 units have a rent supplement. This is not right, sir? You mean it's inaccurate or what?
It is inaccurate.
Oh. There are more that...
The 2,400 units that Mr. Cox mentioned are in, as he correctly stated, either completed, under construction, or under the in the drawing board. Out of those, only 332 units have been completed under rent supplement. But there is a... He can give you the figures.
That's what I wanted to ask.
That are.
And then this gentleman said that.
Well, Dan, they're your figures, and you can interpret them better than I can. Go ahead.
Let's keep to that one question so we can clarify it. Now,
yes.
Would you ask that question again?
Yes. There are 2,400 units, either completed or under construction or on the drawing board, insured by FHA under 221D3. How many are going to involve rent supplement, and how many will not?
I yield to Dan Grady.
Out of the 2,396 units, 668 are programmed for rent supplement.
668?
Right. Mm-hmm. The balance of them are programmed for BMIR.
What does that mean?
The low market interest rate at 221D3. I also would like to mention as a point of clarification that a substantial number, although undetermined, of the 221D3 below market interest rate will in fact probably be financed under provisions of the 1968 Housing Act, which will become
the numbers,
section 236.
Yeah.
And
Which means
this is a new section, and it will mean a subsidized interest rate with rent coming very close.
It'll be
rent supplement, therefore about 25% of the income of the occupant.
Now, can you interpret that for us in straight language so that we all get it? Don't have to use the figures. What does that mean?
Under the present subsidized programs that are available and which we are talking about here, there are three different programs which we should talk about. One of them is offers apartment units at a fixed rate, which, as you correctly stated, is somewhere around 25% below what is the market rent. Rents which in the San Diego area generally are in the order of about $110 to $115 for a two-bedroom apartment, $127 for a three-bedroom apartment, and any family that qualifies moves into one of those apartments and pays those rents. The other program is a rent supplement program where a family that qualifies pays either 25% of their income towards rent, or in case of welfare recipients, pays the welfare allocation towards rent. There will be taking place in the next few months a number of programs which will be financed under a new program taking effect now, and where the families will again be required to pay 25% of their income towards rent.
One other question for clarification. You used the word qualified several times. What do you mean, those who qualify?
Qualified,
how do they qualify?
Means that they will have, they have a total income which is below the maximum income limit set for these programs. The income varies depending on the size of the family and the program. The rent supplement program, the maximum income is approximately the one that qualifies for admission to public housing. The rent program is one which is varies from approximately $6,000 total income for a family of about four to a maximum of $11,250 annual income for a family of seven or eight persons. And under the last program that I mentioned, which is going to take place, the maximum income for admission to these units will be 135% of the maximum income allowed for admission to rent supplement projects.
What did he say?
Mr. Chairman, so we spend the next 20 minutes talking about the immediate problems, and we can get to the long range on the second item on the agenda.
Yeah.
Let's talk about rent control, and I think we wanted to ask Mr. Butler his position on rent control. Number one.
I understand your need, your urgency, Mr. Bullard, but it's important to clarify these definitions as we go along.
But it's
long
range, Mr. Chairman.
Not sure
we got
them
all understood.
No, Mr. Chairman, now, in connection with the breaking down these codes into lay language, I still come up with 1/4 of the 2,400 units that are under construction will be under the rent supplement program. It says probably, I heard the word probably, that is a possibility that some of these may in the near future be some type of way. But out of the 2,400 units, 668 of them are under the rent supplement program. And this means 1/4 of those units.
Yes.
Is this what you're saying now?
Yes. That's what he said.
So this is a part of the short range goal.
Yes. Is it possible now to do something about those in terms of item number 2, short range?
Mr. Chairman, is like
what
I said.
Do you mean by doing something about those?
Are they available for some people now, tomorrow, next week?
No. Out of it, those that I mentioned, as Mr. Cotton said, the first project will be available for occupancy in early part of 1969, and the second project of 400 units.
No, don't give us that. Just stick with the early part. What do you mean early part of 69?
January 69.
January, February.
Right.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, he was talking about the vague visitor, and I stand there, those 269 units, there's already 1,500 applicants there for those 269 units.
That's what we're trying to get at. Really, then, while that exists in terms of in the next 4 months, it doesn't really, because it's already taken.
So we can
eliminate that as one of the short-range solutions as such, because it's already taken.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
By the same token, those 1,500 people are living someplace today, so they'll open up. The 268 will open up some vacancies.
Substandard.
Not all of them, Charles. Some of them are.
Two or three may not be.
Dan, you talked about the maximum income level I think it's also crucial we talk about minimum income levels in order for eligibility, recognizing the fact that the lower income families will not be eligible for some of these projects. Can you spell out the bottom on this?
The bottom is generally up to the manager of the project. If he feels that that family can afford to pay the rent, he can admit that family. There is no, under any of these programs, there is no legal or regulatory minimum income required, except that, as I mentioned before, under the rent of the program, the family is required to pay 25% of their income.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking of this 70-10 on the rent supplement, where the rent supplement will not pay more than 70% of the rent. And if your family income is not enough to pay the 30%, then you're not eligible.
Yeah.
Can you spell that out in dollars and cents roughly for us, say, for a typical family of five in a three-bedroom?
Under a... I don't have the figures, and I don't want to give figures, but I was not prepared to answer that. I don't have the
I suggest we stay away from too much technical. Yeah. What you're saying is that under number one on the torch demand, that the apartment manager or owner has the option to decide who or does not and who does. And that's one of the points here that they are asking about now. Rent control, from their point of view, would cut through part of that. He has indicated that the option would be left with the manager renting the apartment. They are suggesting that something be done about that in terms of short range. So we don't have to get into the technical if you keep your concept clear. Follow me? So I'm suggesting that we stay away from the technical and talk to that point that they are bringing up.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to know what qualifies a person to move into these units. My understanding is that in reaction to what someone said about the houses that would be left would not be substandard. Is the qualification of these people, reason to move into these new units, is that the house they're living in are substandard? Is this correct?
That's one of the possible qualifications that can get you into the unit. The others being age, displaced by government action like a freeway, what else is there?
Income level.
Yeah, if you have to have a certain...
Now, if this be the case then, Mr. Chairman, we, the people who will move out into those units, the units that they're moving out of will not be adequate people to move in. If someone determined that they're substandard already and they're building houses to get them out, then we still would have this shortage of houses, because you're only building a house for a person who's really outdoors, so to speak.
Or wouldn't one of the short-range things be, you've got empty houses that are below standard now, and doing something about those houses? Is that part of the short-range suggestion?
We've looked into that and determined that it isn't that much, you know, and we figure that we checked into the highway-owned houses that are boarded up now, and we determined there's something like 15 of them available. Mr. Allen says 9 more. I'm saying that's a possibility, and we're definitely looking into that, but I don't think that's enough to help the current problem. We may come up with, say, a total of 50 units or something on this nature that might be used if they're rehabilitated, and you know, find out who owns them and how much money it costs to fix them back up, etc.
All right, let's look at then number one there and ask some questions to the people who can talk for rent control. There are several people in the room who can give us some idea about that. Yes, can you talk about the legal aspects of that?
Yeah, the cities of Los Angeles and San Francisco in California after World War II did enact rent control laws for a brief period. These laws, legally in a charter city, may be enacted provided the legislative body can find the circumstances such as to call out the police power, which is the public health, safety, and welfare. It's on that basis that rent control laws are predicated. For this city council to make that legislative finding would seem to me to require a situation of such emergency and such extreme nature as to bring forth what is a very powerful and a very difficult thing for a government to do, and that is to regulate the prices that people may sell a service for. And you can only do it when you call out the kind of a situation where a public health is being affected. That is, people are sleeping in parks and on the streets. Where the safety is being affected, that is substandard housing and, you know, 30 people in a room and that kind of a thing. If those circumstances exist, and if a legislative finding such as that could be made, then, under the law, a rent control ordinance probably would be sustained. As you probably know, New York City has had a rent control law for years. It's a very intricate, involved thing, assuring a 6% return on capital, I think, a 2% depreciation schedule. Its administration, first, to develop the thing is not easy. Next, its administration is extremely difficult. The violation constitutes a misdemeanor, and you would have to set up, I would guess, a substantial administrative agency to administer rent control. It would have to go across the board. It would have to affect all housing units, not only those available to low-income units. And would raise, as I say, a substantial, just got a lot of problems in it. So that's so much of the rent control. On the eviction freeze, if I could just talk about that as long as I got the floor. I know of no power in the city that would enable us to suspend the application of state laws which have to do with the eviction of persons for non-payment of rent. I know of no power that we would have as a city to a stay eviction or to freeze eviction. At the state level, surely the state legislature could probably develop something along those lines, but I don't know of any legal power that we would have to accomplish that.
Mr. Chairman.
Hold a minute, Charles. Let some others now react to that, too, please. Yes.
Warren Blanton of the Apartment and Rental Owners Association. I think our main objective here is to get additional housing built.
At least one of them.
I know of no quicker way to discourage the building of houses by private capital and the financing of them by financial institutions than by discussing the possibility of a blanket rent control. Now, I don't think I have to prove that to anybody here. Now, you can all just ask yourselves, would you put your life savings on the line in face of a situation like that where you'd be faced with blanket rent control and the impossibility of evicting bad tenants? So I just want to throw this out for you. The apartment house owners are greatly interested in getting housing here, and as the largest investors probably of any group in the city in real estate, we are for it. We don't know all the answers, but I don't think this is one of them. Now, there may be other ways of providing for rent control or getting at it in some way, which I'm sure in some cases is needed. But the statements like appeared in last Friday's paper, in which we carried about a 5 or 6 column spread on demand for rent control, this has already dried up a couple of building projects, and it's going to dry up a lot more.
Mr. Chairman,
I'm talking about it.
I'd like to react to him, Mr. Chairman.
Ray first. All right.
Yeah, I think that's a legitimate point. But however, private capital and private building isn't helping anyhow. It isn't helping the people we're talking about. They're not building units for large families with low income. So I think that's a legitimate point, but I don't think it speaks to what we're talking about. So in that respect, it wouldn't hurt any if we stopped, you know.
Mr. Chairman, the thing that was mentioned on last week, apparently what is needed is some type of urban development, and the only way that you can work at an urban development program successfully is under federal control. If you leave it under local control, you have the same reaction that this gentleman just made a moment ago, that we're not going to put our money in anything that we can't see we can get out of it, something valuable. Now, we had this to happen in another city, and you have to bring it before the voters. Vote in urban development under federal control. Now, you have stiff opposition from the landowners in this thing, but it will work out successful and to the satisfaction of everybody concerned if we do it. Secondly, this is what we were talking, these are one of the things that we were talking about here in our recommendation for this whole Citizens Advisory Board. These are some of the things that we're talking about, and if people could understand that we're not trying to prosecuted by a certain type of kangaroo court. We're concerned about the forward movement of the city, then we can get along someplace, because when we get through with this thing here, these recommendations here, what they're saying that they need to do on the TARS, we're going to have somebody to work up some type of intelligence presentation to the people who can affect change. And the only one we know is the city council. The council just stated a moment ago that there is a possibility, if the thing is presented to the council in the proper manner, that they will do something about it, because it's been done in other cities where you have similar problems. Now, we can point to hundreds of cases in Southeast San Diego in particular, and I know in other areas of the city, where there are people that are living or almost sleeping out of doors, as the man said. You look out and see the stars as you sleep at night. But somebody's got to be bona fide. You've got to have somebody with a portfolio to do these particular things. And this is why I ask the question, what legal matter, I mean, what legal challenge can we go through? And the city council is the only one that we have. And if it's something in violation of the the charter, then we're going to have to try to encourage through public opinion and sentiment and executive order that the thing will be changed in order to conform to our meeting request. These are things that we're confronted. We can sit there and talk all day about what's existing and who's going to do who, but until we get something down and go to some people with it, we're not going to get anywhere. Why do we have any action?
All right, we're still then on the item you're talking about, rent control, administrative angle of it, and so forth. The reaction back here. Anderson?
Yeah. I did a little investigation on my own yesterday. The landlord sent me a notice that it's going to raise the rent $5.
On your property?
On my property. So what I did is I called on to the tax office, and I had the man down at the tax office give me some information about the property. And I found out in 1961 the property was valued at $42,000. In 1966 it depreciated, it was down to $37,000. Okay, now over that period of about 2.5 years, the rate of interest was, in 1966, the rate of interest on his taxes now was 8.536%. 1967 was 8.886%. 1968, it was 8.407%. Now, the new bill that he's going to get that he doesn't know that I know about is 8.803%. Now, that's about 4% less than he was paying prior to this fiscal year, but he still increased the rent $5. Now, I don't understand that. I mean, figures are not one of my, but I just don't understand. How can you raise the rent if the taxes are the same
old? Let me say that if that property is depreciated in value in the last 4 years, it's the exception and not the rule in San Diego. Most property in San Diego has increased in value considerably in the last 4 years, in whatever period it is.
This came right
so something must have happened to the property that depreciated it. But it's the exception and not the rule.
How long have you been living in it, Anderson?
The tax office won't give you one vote. And this is from the tax office.
Maybe we should purchase that property now.
Mr. Chairman, you see the odds, we'll make a deal with you and you'll invest in that
Mr.
property.
Mr. Chairman, last week we read in the newspapers that Mr. Butler said the state preempted the city from implementing the housing a rent control. We'd like for the news media to know that this is not I read it in the Union Tribune, I think other people read it, that state.
Well, let's ask him, Charles. He's sitting here.
Hear him state this at the meeting, but the paper did.
All right, let's
say the state preempts.
The state has preempted the area of fair housing laws.
Well, the paper said rent control.
I can't believe the paper was misleading.
I They've always been very careful actors in the state.
I think we have a gentleman in the house who was going to be on his TV newscast also made the same statement. Is that not true, sir? Did you make a statement on housing last week? With one of you guys?
Oh, he's a weatherman.
So y'all know.
We're
all these reactions. regular thing going on.
Well, this is important, John. Don't be too impatient now. We're trying to get in, too. So, we share your urgency, but hold on.
But I can't wait all day. We have been told that rent control would dry up capital that there is to invest in building housing. I assume that this is true, but why is it that rent control would dry up this capital, this investment that is available? Is it because that there, that perhaps the profits would be limited to a reasonable amount instead of an excessive, unlimited amount of profit? Or what is the reason that rent control would dry up capital? After all, the gas and electric company has a form of rent control, or there's a limit placed by the government on what they can charge. There's a limit placed on public transportation. The airlines can't change their rates because they serve the public. They can't change their rates without approval by a governmental agency. So if rent control, placing a control here, where a person must live, out of the weather and so forth, why is it that the same type of control here is going to dry up by the capital?
You want to answer that?
Sure, I'd like to answer that. But all the examples you cite, transportation, gas, electricity, and the other are public utilities regulated in the interest of the public. We have not yet come to the point in this country, I take it, where housing is considered to be in the nature of a public utility and subject to governmental regulation. Now, it's entirely consistent. You could certainly hold an opinion to that effect, but if so, you would bring about, I would take it, a radical alteration and change in the form and nature not only of the economic system, but of the whole concept of property on which this thing is based.
All right, let's drop the examples and just leave the question. Why would rent control dry up private capital?
Want an answer to that?
In federal loans.
All right. Want to react to it over there?
The experience in the past has shown that a good many inequities occur by rent control agencies, and they have not been set up. In many cases they have, to understand the economics of apartment house ownership. So it gets down to this sort of a thing. A man invests a lot of money in a property, and he doesn't like to have some disinterested party telling him how to run it. Another thing, we have just finished a period in which taxes and operating costs have risen steadily, say, since about 1960, in which there has been no increase in rent, as a matter of fact, actually decreases. So at this time, we have a number of apartment houses at this point, the existing ones, have been running at a 4, 5, or 6 year deficit. So these are problems that come out. Now, I feel that for irresponsible owners in any group of people, apartment house owners or whatever it is, there has to be some form of control. All I'm saying is that I don't think we should blat it to the skies if we want to get interest aroused in the building of property. Now, I think I can cite some cases now of exorbitant rents that I have. I just spent a period of investigation on this. I had just checked at this point about 6,000 units on a telephone survey in the past couple of days. And I have found the increases range from 39% increase to none whatsoever, and in one case we've had a 12.5% increase since 1954.
Well, may I interrupt you there? Did you get our statistics that were presented here the last 2 weeks?
No.
They range from 0% to 100%.
I saw that in the paper, and I'm sure that you can dig out the 100% increases in rent. But over what period of time was this? I'm talking about since the first of the year. And
go ahead. I think we just need to get the base so we all talk about this.
I just want to answer that one thing. That this is the reason that there is a fear, and just so from past experiences, that these boards set in many cases inequitable rent, and whatever their batting average is, it's enough to scare a lot of people.
All right, then. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I should point out that there actually are rent controls on the 2,400 units that Mr. Cotton spoke of. These are upper limits of rent that are established by FHA in these federally assisted programs.
All right, we have other things on this list. We have some FHA people here. We got Kimball Moore here. Let's look at temporary housing and code enforcement then. It's two of the other items on here.
All right, have we dissolved rent control? We'd like to, Mr. Chairman, be right there for a minute.
All right.
First of all, let's talk about why do we need search. And let me, I want to be strong here, Mr. Chairman. Mr. King said we could all live together as human beings, or we could all perish together as food. Now, we are being kicked out. We are being exploited by absentee landlords right now. And when you want to touch me, you touch me when you put my baby outside, when you put my wife outside. And that's what's happening. People right now do not have any place to go. And we want to have some place to go. And what's the main issue here is, what can we do to stop landlords from exploiting us, from raising our rents from $75 a month to $160 a month? And we can't pay it. Then they tell us, if you don't like how we raise the rent, get out. And we don't have anywhere to go. And we keep saying, get out of town. We move into garages. We might have to move somewhere else. We might have to move down here. But we're going to move somewhere. Now, we can do this. We can work this out together. We could perish, like Mr. King said, as food.
I think we do have a problem.
So we go around here, we're talking all over the problem. Let's talk to the problem. We, Mr. Linebeck and I, Mr. Swissgable and Mr. Adams, Mr. Logan, we are right there. We see the problem. We have many problems that we cannot solve. We can't find houses for people. And we see these mothers crying and all of this and every day. And this is why it's so important that we talk about what we can do now, and we thought we brought something that the city could do. The city could give us 1,000 temporary homes, and that the city could, if they want to, under the rent-lease program, lease trailer homes, mobile homes, and provide 750 new right off the bat, right now. I think this is what we should be talking about, right now.
Let me add before you do. I think the question is a good one. For those of you who were here last time, if we can stop for a moment and look at what he's saying, regardless whether you agree or not, we presented the increases last week here and all the other evidence from the Navy to even Mr. Allen's dramatic and factual presentation of the problems he himself was facing and others, that right now there are people who don't have places to go. We had the evidence of the eviction notices the last time that we talked about and got some interpretations from the legal minds here at that time. There is a problem in terms of what can be done with those who don't have a place to go. Is there anything that can be done? Kimball, I'd like to hear some suggestions from you and Jim and others about that one problem. What can be done right now in the next 6 months? I'll make the now the 6 months. Give it a leeway time. What probably can be done about some of these families?
Carol, on this leased housing program, I would agree that we should utilize it to increase the supply, and I think there's a factual matter, John, that a great bulk of these units will probably be produced in terms of new and additional units rather than necessarily representing existing units. I think that there's an opportunity to utilize this program in the creation of an addition to the housing supply on the strength of a long-term lease. A developer is able to secure financing which would permit him to produce new housing to in turn be contracted with the city. and in turn rent it to tenants in need at rents that they can afford to pay. On this angle of utilization of mobile homes in relation to this increased supply, we've had preliminary discussions with HUD on that. Mr. Rask, maybe you can shed some current light on it. Apparently, the agency really hasn't gotten into mobile homes to any extent up to this time. Is there any
I know of no on that? I know of no area where they're utilizing mobile homes for the leased housing program. There may be some. I'm not aware of them.
Does that mean it can't be done?
It means that I know of no place where they have done it. That's all it means. Mr. Moore said they're having a little discussion with HUD. Possibly it can be worked out.
What about other possible, aside from HUD, sticking with that concept of mobile units, temporary, what have you, what other possible creative approaches can we use, aside from going through HUD? As one, what other possible, sticking with the mobile, temporary idea? Kimball or Jim?
Well, if you keep putting the qualifications on that of mobile, I don't know
what I'm mobile out temporarily.
Okay. I don't know what I'm talking about because I don't have any facts on this. But I think all of us have seen a very large area known as Camp Elliott. It's got a lot of public buildings on it. I don't know what condition these are in. I don't know whether these could be modified for habitation, whether there are federal regulations that make it impossible to attempt anything like this. But there are buildings there. There are buildings that are not being occupied. And it would seem to me that at least this is a possibility. It may be very remote or it may be out of the question. If we're talking about something that is a dire emergency right here and now, there's one set of quarters, so to speak.
Before anybody else interrupts, let's clear up the business of Camp Elliott. Ray, did we ever get from the congressman, from the senators, etc., ruling on whether or not, in fact, that was excess or not, or what the status of that was? We were looking into it some time ago.
I'm not sure of all that. I have discussed with some of the military people the possibilities of Camp Elliott. First of all, the way I understand it, a lot of the units that are there were for bachelors, which means they're, long rooms with bunk beds and common showers and this kind of thing, which is not suitable for family habitation, which means, money to fix them up in that respect. Would the government allow military as well as non-military personnel to come in there? I don't know. I believe that there are portions of the Camp Elliott area that are restricted for habitation because of Miramar. I don't know if that's a factor here in the buildings that Jim's talking about. There's possibilities, I think.
FHA, any sticking with Camp Elliott, what about that possibility?
Well, our function is to ensure loans, and we don't go into the construction phase of this at all.
You have no information on that, Camp Elliott.
Carol, may I make a comment on that? I think you'll find that all of the buildings in Camp Elliott are within the flight zone of Miramar Naval Air Station. And I don't think that's a logical place to look for quick housing.
Well, I disagree on that. The whole peninsula, the whole Ocean Beach, Point Loma peninsula is under the flight pattern of Lindbergh. I think if you've got a problem, you can stand a little noise.
I don't think you'd find the United States government would release that area on their flight pattern for any use for housing.
Carol, I can say that we can sure check into this. This has not really been explored by the city. I think that it is an idea. It may be a little remote, but I think the city can go into this with the Navy and see if there is any angle here.
You can look into Camp Elliott as one of the possibilities then. All right, let's go back and stick with other possible temporary measures.
Let me just bring out one point. When we were discussing mobile homes, Mr. Chairman, we had taken a good look in our area to see how we could utilize the mobile homes. We know that we have properties where we used to have low rent houses on Ocean View and Logan, where there are concrete slabs I suspect that they already have water and everything there, because this is where they had the low-rent houses before. They tore down.
They were torn down.
The government. And the slabs are still there. A trailer could easily be moved in on that slab. Many slabs there. Do you know how many 7 foot is? But a lot of slabs where we had temporary houses. Well, when I first came to San Diego, that's all we had in Southeast San Diego anyway, was temporary houses. So that's 20 years ago. So now those slabs are still there. We can move mobile homes right in on those slabs.
What about that idea? Another idea. What about it, somebody? Kimball, any idea? Jim, go ahead.
Well, let me just make one observation. I'm not trying to think of a reason why that can't be done. But present regulations, which can be changed, regulating the location of trailer parks in the city of San Diego, go along this line, that you can put a trailer park in any residential zone from what we call the R2 or a duplex zone on up through the apartment zones, providing there's at least 5 acres or more in the site that you're talking about, and providing you secure a conditional use permit or permission from the planning commission to put that facility in. That conditional use permit is there to provide for the kind of screening, the kind of environmental protection for surrounding areas. Because I think, as you all will recognize, trailer parks to some, particularly homeowners, scare them. And so they have constantly wanted certain protection so that if one went in near them, there were certain kinds of environmental controls so that this did not become what I think all of us don't want in the way of the old-fashioned, typical trailer park. But right now, on that particular site that you're talking about, I think the zoning would basically permit it. I'm not sure of the acreage. There isn't anything that would prevent the city council from changing the minimum size of a trailer park district in a residential zone, except opposition from the general public, not on the question of providing housing in this instance, but on the question of introducing trailer parks into otherwise residential areas. It's a problem, but it could be overcome.
Assuming then that you don't take it as trailer parks as such, can those sites where the slabs are be utilized for temporary housing of some kind, not mobile units, to still get his idea across? You have the slabs, water, etc. agreement. Can some temporary housing be brought in there and not legally, technically, mobile units? Is that possible?
You talking about prefab units?
Or some kind. Yeah. Some kind of temporary. But taking the same concept, since mobile, is regulated already, with the regulations, the restrictions, what about just bringing in some kind of temporary structure?
It'd probably be easier to go the mobile route than it would be some kind of temporary structure brought in. I mean, that sounds like okay.
Streets, sidewalks, parking lots are already there.
Well, let him finish then. Tim, you were saying it's easier to go the mobile route.
This land, incidentally, presently is owned by the federal government,
Right.
And there's two parcels, as a matter of fact. One used to be called Preble to the south, and there's Bacon to the north. Each side is 15, 16 acres in size. We've been working on the more northerly one, the one closest to Mountain View Park, in terms of being a cultural educational center. Perhaps you know some of the planning that's gone into that. The southernmost one, we feel, and when I say we, I'm talking really about the Southeast Development Planning Committee, feels that should go into residential development in an R1 pattern, I guess, isn't that right, Jim? Or low density?
Low density.
But coming specifically to the possibility of getting some kind of stopgap housing, interim housing, on one of these sites. Let's assume that maybe there was some way that we can work out where you can utilize mobile homes in the lease program, that there's some way whereby one of these sites has some GSA in the private ownership, and sponsor who was willing to bring mobile home units onto there, which in turn the city, acting as a housing authority, could enter into a lease contract with. There conceivably could be a parlay of this nature. There's a lot of sticky problems en route, some of which Mr. Goff has referred to, but it's an outside possibility.
I think his idea of trailers, or mobile homes has definite possibilities been drawn up, and it's within the province of this group to get the committee to really investigate this matter. I think that it does have possibilities, and it should be just talked about drop. It should be brought to a head. We must have 50, 60, 70 trailer parks in the area. At one time, I was mixed up with trailer parks. And there'd be quite a number of those that there might be expandable, so you have that possibility as well. And then there's a wide variety of mobile homes that would fit into almost any type of zoning that you want to talk about. I think we would get a little trouble if you tried to put in and pull them in on temporary vacant lots in the city. You're going to catch it from various homeowners around. But to designate definite spots, either get them from the government or expansion under present locations or other types of things, I think there's definite possibility here.
Tim, are you going to work with Torch on that possibility too, then? Or Torch can work with Kimball on that?
I'm happy to.
All right. You mentioned another, I see a hand way back there. Let me comment on one thing you mentioned. The expansion of present trailer sites. It brings in the direct confrontation with the whole problem of discrimination in trailers. Grace is here, Mrs. Ridoff from FEPC, and if she wishes to comment on it, fine. But we, in the past 3 years, have run into some stiff opposition in the trailer sites and business of racial discrimination. I suspect of all the areas that you have not heard about or have heard about, racial discrimination is probably greatest in the trailer site in the city of San Diego as well as the county of San Diego. And maybe Grace wants to just highlight that a second. I'm saying that if we're going to talk about that idea, we then have to look at also utilizing the influence of the city, the state, FEPC, and all the other agencies in breaking down the rigid racial discrimination in trailer sites, and Grace has found some of the cases, as well as we have.
Yeah, we, this year, have had sort of a few from trailer parks, but those that we have been around the military bases, particularly Camp Pendleton, where a number of service people bring their wives and family out as an economy measure. And we've had a great number of those, as a matter of fact, around the state. And some respondents, interestingly enough, who have signed with the military their pledge that they would make their facilities available to anybody regardless of race, creed, color, or national origin. But you know, Carol, aside from trailer parks, I believe, only based on my subjective experience, that in the whole matter of housing, whether it's an apartment, whether it's a duplex, whether it's a house, whether it's a trailer park, that this is an inherent, implicit problem, so that when we're talking about any housing, I am just presuming that we're accepting the fact that discrimination is a real thing, and that in all of our plans that we have to pursue the plans provided, that we have some sort of enforceable commitment for open occupancy.
Right, that's in your actions. Anderson, you were trying to get in earlier. Have anything?
Well, I was going to say that one of the gentlemen said that you have to take in consideration the location of housing that's surrounded the trailer park. Well, really, I don't think we should be concerned about what the people next door are going to say, because, you see, they have their own property. They have a home to live in. We're talking about people that are outside. So I'm sure that in our neighborhood, we wouldn't have that type of a problem, because everybody has this acute awareness of the fact that most of these people we're talking about now are outside. And I don't think that they would rent these people an opportunity to be indoors through the winter months and some of the other inclement days ahead, just to live temporarily in that neighborhood. I don't think this is going to be a problem at all.
I'm going to say that as we're talking about trailers, I hope that we all keep in mind the fact that it is definitely, you're talking about temporary situations, very temporary, aren't you, Carol? Because I think of a family, unless you get into these super deluxe expandable models where you have a three bedroom, chances are those trailers are going to be little teensy places with a family all crammed in, left there and forgotten. Their housing problem will not have been solved in the long range planning. Just a temporary, very temporary. It's a horrible place to have kids.
That's why we have a second item.
Could we clarify one thing on trailers? This, I'm sure most of you are aware of, but there are trailers now that exceed in footage to the most luxurious apartments and in some cases homes that we have. And the prices upon the mobile homes, and I don't hold any stock in any mobile homes, is so much less than any type of building that you could build. For instance, I know of a recent purchase of a used mobile home, 50 feet by 10 feet, which has 500 feet in it, and this is a pretty fair-sized one-bedroom apartment as far as the thing talking about built 10, 12 years ago. So it's not all that bad, and there are, of course, the small mobile homes, which would be inadequate, but I think that there would also be available. It's not a perfect solution, I don't mean that, but I think we're getting close to something not too bad.
Just thinking that the trailer is the short range, helps to solve the short range problem because it's very quick and easy to erect the trailer size as compared to apartments. One of the things is, I think the only way I could see how it could possibly work is the city perhaps buying the you're using land, the city land or so forth, because most of the people cannot afford to purchase the trailer. And the trailers, at least, they don't have money to purchase them right off, so they would have to work out some kind of either a plan to purchase it or a rental plan, whereas they could get low-income families into the trailers.
The torch is going to work with Kimball and the other zoners. I think all of those factors are the factors that are really going to have to be worked out. So I would hope that Torch would immediately set up some kind of vehicle. We've got two ideas concrete there, Camp Elliott and trailer site possibility, that Kimball Moore has agreed to look at possibilities along with Jim here in terms of changing some regulations that may be necessary. Dick?
Oh. Just one question about the potential for financing of the home itself. This is an extension of the question that was asked. What is the potential for financing? Is there any ideas at all about it? I'm kind of lost in terms of that, the initial financing. Not for the property itself, but the sake of the home.
We're suggesting that that comes under the leased housing program, which means that somebody would own the trailers, the city would lease them on a basis.
City Capital Authority.
Right. Which I don't think that represents a problem.
That gets around the other big problem he suggested. That's a big problem. Dick, go ahead.
I assume that we're going to get to another agenda item very shortly, to be fair with the agenda. And therefore, I'd like to go back to one question I'd like to ask the gentleman, the apartment house owner. You spoke against rent control and stated your reasons. If we did not have rent control, would your association be willing to use whatever means you have to try to keep rents from getting out of line? What could you do? What would you do?
We don't have the power over our members that you might say that the attorneys and the Bar Association have and so forth, but you, I'm sure, will understand that we are extremely concerned about skyrocketing rents. And the renegades who raise rents indiscriminately, this is absolutely the worst public relations that we can have. And we continuously exhort our members to make reasonable rent increases. And the examples that I have found, or think I have found, of exorbitant rent increases by absentee landlords, which has been brought out here, I think of one group of units owned by a New York group who made rental increases, I believe, of around 45%. Well, this is the kind of thing that kills us as people who live here and make our living in the apartment house industry. So we are very concerned with this. We don't have all that we can do, unless there are some other suggestions, is to talk strongly about this, and we do it at every meeting. We had some unfortunate experiences of outside speakers who came in when things got good and said, "You're crazy if you don't raise your rents." And I know that some of our members got carried away, as others do. We represent perhaps only 10% of the apartment house owners in the area. But we certainly, I want to get this straight, that this is the worst kind of PR that we can have, to have these indiscriminate rent increases.
But you can't do anything.
Only moral persuasion, you might say. Now,
you're telling them to stop doing it.
Yeah, we tell them the reasons for it, and in specific instances. Now, we take about 600 calls a week down there at the office, and a lot of them say, "What should I do about rent?" and so forth. And we tell them outright on this, and if we think you should be very careful about the raising of rents, then we give them the reasons for it. And this is about all we can do. Now, if an attorney gets that line, he can be hauled on the carpet by the Bar Association to lose his life. All we can do is to kick him out of the association.
We're
nothing.
Oh, this is the guy's everything you stand for.
So we'd like to have a little more power and throw our weight around. We think we know how to run apartments, but all we can do is suggest.
All right, we have the two items, another item on here, and I will ask if you're ready to move on to that last one, and the one that Grace brought up, which is not included, and usually requires several months of discussion, as you know. I'm looking at the last one called code enforcement. Landlords must be forced to repair substandard housing and all the other things that talked about here.
Sure.
I would add one other part of that enforcement. Racial discrimination without qualification, simply because of color or national origin, is indeed at the basis of Grace's whole operation. It is real, it is bad, it is still worse, it is still bad, and running through all of this is a big problem of the regardless of what happens, as Grace pointed out. We have that problem. Moving on then to code enforcement, unless Charles or someone else wants to go back and pick up some other units. Code enforcement. Done.
We did something with the temporary housing, but we didn't do anything with the rent control other than talk about it. Are we going to do
anything be done about rent control?
Chairman, I think...
Hold up, please, Charles. No hold
up. What?
Anything can be done about rent control. I'll get you back in a minute. He raised a direct question.
Legal matter.
He gave us what
the conditions are. He said the conditions of the rent control, what you have to do to get rent control. And I guess this is what you said.
Yeah, you got to be terribly sure, and this is going to be totally misunderstood. The conditions under which a city can exercise its police power to impose what I think you have in mind of rent control laws are very extreme. They're of the greatest urgency. You've got to get a real emergency situation going. Absent these things, a rent control law would not be legal. If you can find these things, and they can be substantiated on statistics and otherwise, then you can probably support a rent control bill.
Well, we have them, Mr. Chairman. We have.
Let me read something that I'm quoting here, too, and has the proper citations if you want to check into this. But it says, "The police power, common, and the power to make laws to secure the comfort, convenience, peace, and health of a community." So I'm reading that to say that it's a little bit more than you originally indicated, that it involves the comfort, convenience, peace of the community, as well as the health. And I think we definitely have to take that into consideration.
I can suggest something that ought to be maybe done, and you can plow through that, Don, it seems to me. The Buck City Attorney, Ed, has given us certain conditions added to those that Ray just mentioned. These are conditions only under which such a police power can be used. Would it not be appropriate then to take all the conditions that you have and write them down tomorrow, tonight, bring them back to Ed and say, look, here are the conditions we've been talking about. Here are the documentation. Where can we go from there? Is not that what you were essentially saying? That it has to be examined, Ed, in the light of those conditions?
Sure, and I'd have to go on and say this too, that from what I've been able to read in this area, that I'm persuaded that the imposition of rent control laws, certainly in New York and in L.A. and in San Francisco, and they only stayed on for a brief time after World War II, I'm told from all the literature I've looked at that the rent control laws did not accomplish what you expected to accomplish. And I'd suggest to you that I think it's a simplistic slogan that looks towards a solution of a very deep and a very real and a very complex problem. And don't get hung up on these simple solutions to difficult problems such as a political party is about to get hung up on.
I don't think we should be held back though, simply because it's had problems other places, and let's look at it further and see what possibilities are.
You want you to know all of this, Tim?
Mr. Jesse was about to say something first.
Yes, Gerald, I'd like to address myself to the item permanent housing before you move on to code enforcement. Perhaps
louder. Let's get back to you in a minute then on the permanent bit. Let's clear up this other point once and for all. So where are we going?
Once and for all, Mr. Chairman, the conditions that we have that came from the state do exist right now in San Diego.
It would be necessary to document them, write them out, and discuss them as well.
We did it last week.
Did you know what Ed is suggesting?
Yes. The conditions here were states where the community it has to deal with the property, conveniences, and peace and health of the community.
No, he is suggesting that they be in a particular bill of particulars. Write it out, 10 pages, 25, 100, and give him concrete cases like you had here last time and other conditions, and then sit down with it and make a recommendation on that. That's what he's suggesting. In order to make it legal, you've got to do it that way.
If you're suggesting that this piece of paper that was distributed last week would be sufficient to trigger the police power, then I tell you immediately you haven't got
enough. Well, then give us some guidelines then as to what would be the condition. Let us know. Then you say that's not enough. What do we need? We have people who don't have a place to stay. What do we need?
He
mentioned something about a book or something that we have to write for you.
But we'll help you with that. We know what you're saying, Charles. We have to prepare it, is all you're saying.
I'd like to make a motion that the TART group work in conjunction with the Housing Authority and Mr. Kimball's committee and Mr. Dowell in working out the particulars in the temporary and the permanent housing as far as short range, long range goes off the sun. Because we can't solve them here. And if they're legal matters, then that's to be discussed.
Leave it there if that's motion.
I'll make that motion.
Sure. I'll be glad to meet with you and talk to us, Charles.
Been moved and seconded that the TORCH work out these, as stated by Jim, with Housing Authority, Mr. Moore, and Mr. Goff. Question? Discussion?
Question.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposes? Carried. Would you go ahead to Ray and Charles and Dick and the other members of the TORCH and let us know something after you meet with them so we can give you any other input? Jesse?
Yes, Carol. Perhaps I should address this remark to Attorney Butler and Mr. Rath, as well as Mr. Goff. I'm concerned that perhaps we should have some attention addressed to the feasibility of the housing development program sponsored by the new founded housing.
development unit in the city to make the long-range housing development plan relevant to the industrial needs of the community. I don't think, and I think this is very important, I don't think that from a long-range point of view, the housing program should be carried out without very close coordination, close complement with the future growth of the employment complex, industrial complex. For example, along 395, these areas. Now, of course, we'll have to talk about consortiums between the local and perhaps county government, as well as the federal government, in acquiring land that is now extremely expensive, that may in turn be converted to use by private or use of the working man or low-cost housing. Could you address yourself to this? Are we making direction? Are we making effort in this area? Will we? Is this possible?
Are you asking? I'm not sure I'm following you. Are you suggesting that in the general plan for the city, when you lay out an industrial site, that you also consider the housing to be adjacent or near to it, so that people that live there work
That's
there, and
correct.
We don't get hung up on all the transportation of moving people 40 miles between jobs and home? Well, answering that, the Kimball Moore is closer to it than I. The county planning organization tried to put together a thing called TRIP. And TRIP would have put into a computer exactly the thing you're talking about, would teach us where, as the city and the industrial complex grew, would teach where highways should go and how best mass transit could serve the needs of people to move from their homes to their jobs, to their schools, to their recreation areas, and back again. That program did not get off the ground, apparently got extremely expensive. But the county planning organization has at least looked at it. The city task force studying mass transit has made passing reference to it, and so far as I know, it's not gotten beyond the area of people being somewhat aware of it, and the extent to which positive, affirmative steps are being taken, I don't know, but maybe Jim Goff could get in on that.
Well, I'd like to respond to that in an entirely different way than Ed Butler has. There's certainly an appeal to a walk-to-work sort of situation based on difficulties of low income, transportation, and two sources of employment. But I'd suggest that if you're talking about a very long range, 10, 15, 20 years into the future, that basing your action on putting homes next to industrial areas may be the worst thing that you could do.
Well, I don't mean necessarily next to, but very close to.
Well, but that's how close is very close to, and it becomes a judgmental matter. The whole southeast San Diego area right now is suffering from the application of that concept of allowing industrial development in areas where residential development was also encouraged. And the Southeast San Diego Development Committee for the last 2 years has been wrestling with this very question of whether to encourage more industrial growth and making it a bad neighbor, in a sense, with the residential areas that are there, or whether it's better to congregate the industrial areas in some kind of recognizable centers with transportation routes to the areas in which people live. The thing that is very difficult, we have no control in this society of where a person lives and where he works. And sure and pop, if we studied where people actually live and where they work, we find out that all too frequently the reverse situation happens, that the man that is living in a home next to that, to a factory, and I'm using a gross exaggeration of the situation, unfortunately doesn't work in that factory. He works in a job clear way across town. Now, if you could get people to switch around, but obviously it's a utopian sort of situation. I think that the planning programs that are underway in the city are trying to take cognizance of the point that you're making, And it's a question and a judgmental question of how close together you mix two entirely different kinds of land uses. Now, some people will say putting the National Cash Register in a location where it is out on 395 is very bad because no one can get there to work. If housing development were provided out in that area for people to live and work in the area, then this problem could be solved. On the other hand, there's no guarantee that the people that would live there would necessarily work in that particular activity. I don't really know what I'm saying in this, other than it isn't a simple matter of putting the two activities right together and saying, we've now solved our problem for the next 20 years, because I'll just go back again and say Southeast San Diego suffers from that, the over application of that concept right now.
Does that talk to what you're saying?
Yes, it does talk to what I'm saying. However, I'm concerned that more effort can be done from a long-range point of view to make the development of housing more complementary to the industrial growth, so that we don't have the transportation problem for example, people who are unemployed to get to areas where there is available employment. And I'd like to see some direction in this area that I think is very important.
I was hearing Jesse suggest something other than Mr. Goff's answer to. I wasn't hearing Jesse make the point of walk to work. I was hearing him say that which we know has been said a million times in national publications of all cities, that industry is going to the suburbs, they go wherever they have the best deal development, they go wherever they have the best utilities, so on and so forth. And in the suburbs, the minority don't live. And your example of NCR is a very good one. It isn't, in my opinion, lack of transportation. In my opinion, it's because the large company uses the employment facilities and services within the area. And if NCR did what they did, go to the Oceanside Department of Employment, they're not going to get any Negro referral because they don't live there. They're going to get, perhaps, hopefully, Mexican-American because they have a reasonably good-sized population. Yesterday I was in North County, and this I can't verify, but I was told that Burroughs is coming in to around the Oceanside Vista area.
Okay.
Carl said, is this? And I'm told also with hopefully 1,100 employees. Well, again, you're going to have the same really white work pattern. And we know, as an FEPC, because we work with this problem constantly. So we try to overcome, and not very effectively, I fear, that which happens when the industry is put out into the area where there are no minorities. We try to prevail on the employers, we can get to them in time, to change their system of recruitment to actually go into the inner city, Logan Heights. It isn't always successful, number one, and number two, it isn't transportation. It's again for very modestly paid jobs, asking people to spend an inordinate length of time in traveling back and forth, as well as an inordinate amount of expense to get to and from the job. So I would hope, I don't know what the limitations of your housing authority are, but I would certainly hope that to the extent you give thought to transportation or whatever other factors you do to planning, that a very, very high priority be given to what can we do about shifting populations, primarily. Who's going to work in these companies? What's this going to mean to their work pattern? Is it going to be really white, or is it going to be a reasonably well-integrated one?
All right, Judge,
I'd like to add, Carol, that I've heard the argument that the land is too high in certain areas. This is why I mentioned consortium between government, local, county, and federal. Perhaps with the idea of acquiring this land and thereby making it more accessible to people who are in low-income bracket, so that the person will have to pay $35,000 for a house if you want to buy out there. It would take $16,500 or $17,000 for a home somewhere in the city. That's another part of the problem.
Carol, this is an input I haven't had before, and I've never thought about it before, and you're entirely right. I was chairman of the Industrial Development Commission, whose functions are now in the Economic Development Corporation, a non-profit outfit through which the city runs its sales of industrial property, and its primary responsibility is attracting industry here. And this kind of an input into that group would be most important.
May I ask
I haven't heard this. Really, this gets to the very nuts of the thing here, that when we do get these companies investigating, inquiring, there ought to be the input that says we'll get it closer in some of these areas and stop going out to the outskirts. It's,
may I ask a question on this, Kimball and Ed, some of you can answer. We have a housing advisory committee, do we not? That's been operating for the city for a long time. Some advisory and appeal board.
Oh,
whatever that concept is. Can you tell us what it is first before I ask my
architecture
question?
Well, there's a one board that serves in relation to building code enforcement. George, what are the respective names of these two boards?
Building Board of Appeals and the Housing Advisory and Appeals Board.
No, the Housing Advisory and Appeals Board is concerned with exceptions to codes and
in the housing, existing housing.
And concerns itself with abatement of substandard housing.
Right.
Well, what about it, Karen?
I was just wondering, is there a need at this time for members of the different groups that are working in housing? I'm thinking of several, including the topic that was just discussed in terms of industrial parks, EDA, NCR, all the ones that we discussed in another thing called the CIT Employment Task Force, where we're working with this. As a committee that's done all kinds of investigation, has all kind of knowledge about this, is there any place where we can take the idea he's talking about and bring members of Torch and these other groups together and serve as an ongoing arm of Housing Authority as an advisory group, literally to meet with them at all points to give this input?
So don't get the idea that this newly formed Housing Authority is an all-encompassing focal point of city government for all aspects of housing, because it isn't. It's limited strictly to the federally assisted LEAD housing program. Now, with regard to an ongoing vehicle, which hopefully is going to serve the kind of function you suggest, I think it should be San Diego Housing, nonprofit corporation, which Dan Grady here is executive director of, and which does have a representative cross-section of the community, including minority representation. And I think that increasingly we will tend to look to this interdisciplinary body, if you will, as being an ongoing focal point for direction and overall housing strategy. I hope, Dan.
Jim, would this particular phase of community development come under the group that's composed, that the city group in, I don't know the official name of it, but there is a group in every city that invites industry into the city. What is this under? Who? What group is this?
Economic
Development Corporation he's talking about. Economic Development Corporation, along with the Chamber of Commerce.
It's the focal point. The city and the chamber work together with it, but it has the primary responsibility.
Well, I think that they meant that it was something that they had never thought about, really. Their concern was getting people to come in, industry to come into San Diego. I think also in Jess's question was, the inquiry was also stated, the way I heard it, is that if you're inviting a place into the city with X number of people supposed to be hired, that should be housing, adequate housing to put those people in before this particular thing is confirmed.
Just take it into consideration.
Yeah. Now, I don't know who's on that committee, and not concerned, but I am concerned, just to be simple, I think it's an important matter now, because we have, I think this thing came up once before, went through the Council of Churches about national tax rates moving out here, and I don't think we've got a very, I don't think we've got an answer to it at all, because well, the man who was inquiring about it was dismissed from the job, and
we got a lot of information about it, and maybe we need to summarize and bring it here.
We had it, but not public information. But Jesse Mike can pull together, he's on any committees. Maybe you can pull together some of the information, Jesse, about what you're talking about, that industrial park, if you want to bring out that information we have on it. Maybe good. Danny wanted to put it in that. And then we want to get to two other matters here.
Yes, on this subject of permanent housing in the rain, I would like to invite any person who is here, get in touch with us, and we have been wrestling with exactly this problem. We have a committee of San Diego Housing under the chairmanship of Chuck Reed, who is addressing itself to the problem of what is the long-term policy and where, in what areas of the city and the county should various classification of housing be built. For instance, if suddenly we have the financing and the capability of building 500 units of low-income housing, where should we go and put it? And this is a problem which where we find many answers, and we have a number of discussions, and certainly would like to invite anyone to come and join us on this.
All right.
So I'd like to ask the question to the man from the hood. You from the hood.
Yes, sir.
What type of, would we in the city of San Diego to get federal funds to develop this type of urban renewal, would we have to issue a citywide proposition to this effect?
I think you should address your question to Mr. Butler. Renewal is a local determination where it's going to be, if it's going to be,
yes,
how it's going to be, just what the limitations are within the city now. Engaging in urban renewal is something that maybe Mr. Butler.
Well, my question is that still, the funds under the federal program is still available for this type of a thing in the city, in the event that we work out the city.
Yes, sir.
I have one question, too.
Question?
Could you tell us, give us a brief overview of the different kinds of housing programs on the low rent that this city would qualify for?
With the local housing authority, you'll have the opportunity, without a referendum, to get into the leased housing program. Which is what you're doing.
What else?
Let's not leave that so quickly. I think Mr. Moore pointed out that there is a possibility of this housing authority leasing standard, decent housing, if there is any available. If there is none available, let's not laugh here. I'm trying to discuss this thing seriously. If there isn't any available, then you're in a good spot, and here's why. HUD, as Mr. Moore also has pointed out, but I'd like to repeat it, will enter or support local housing authority involving itself in 15-year leases on new construction. Now, it's an accounting nightmare, but the local housing authority can, if it wants to, get involved in a basis where, since the landlord would be responsible for exterior maintenance and interior maintenance of some sort, enter an arrangement whereby the tenant could do some of these items that he's qualified to do. Let's say paint the exterior every once in a while. And in this way, acquire an equity or build up a little down payment. And if he builds up adequate down payment, and if he wants to, he can buy this house. Now, with this built-in feature, the right to buy, and federally financing available to assist him in buying. Remember that the 68 Act includes this home ownership assistance program, whereby HUD will pay part of the monthly installment. So, if the local housing authority were to involve itself in new construction, and I'm sure they're considering this, and they'll have to if there is inadequate vacancy of standard housing, then there will be this built-in feature where you'll get some brand new housing. And I think this is an excellent program. The rent supplement program, of course, is the next best. It serves essentially the same people.
The housing program you're talking about, is that limited to three bedrooms?
Which housing?
The last
brand
one.
Brand
new? Yes.
Well, it'll be limited to whatever could be built for the rents that the owner, or in other words, whatever the owner would be willing to build and lease at what the housing authority can pay. Obviously, there are upper limitations in this regard. This is an excellent program, and in the state of California, I think it's the best possible approach. Rent supplement also, of course, does provide some low-rent housing. For elderly, we have wonderful programs. Of course, we have direct loan programs, and I think you have some in town, don't you, Jim? Where elderly can be housed in excellent housing with rents well below market rate rentals. I believe if we could talk about rent supplement for a moment, for example, I'm aware that in the San Bernardino Riverside Council of Churches, the area they serve, those two counties, that this Council of Churches has decided that maybe they will continue on and beyond the mortgage period, and that someday they might even own these rent supplement projects. So they are they're buying, they're sponsoring construction of rent supplement projects in Colson, two in Riverside, one in Coachella, one in Blythe. It's getting to be a big time operation. I think that it'll probably require the Council of Churches to lay out very little money the way they're approaching it, and they'll probably be assured of tenants with a rent supplement feature. And as I say, in 40 years, they'll own the project outright. So with this carrot, and also an interest in involving itself in this need, I should think that this community would really interest itself in getting some qualified non-sponsor groups to deal with FHA and hopefully develop many more rent supplement rental units than you now have.
All right. It seems to me that several ideas have been, we've acted on three specifically, plus the other one he's talking about, groups to start into this area. I know the time is running out, and if you stay just a couple more minutes, we'll get over these other items. I'm well aware of the fact that we didn't cover the one item, Charles and Ray and the others, on the permanent list. I'm well aware of that, but I think we did cover several items in the temporary list. We got through that pretty well. But Jim here does have one observation to make before we get to two other items we must get to, in terms of when we pick up again an amendment that has to be made to the general plan by next July that's going to involve, can you just capsule what you're talking about?
Well, very briefly, the state planning law has been modified recently to require each city in California to have in their city general plans a housing element. There are no prescribed requirements for what that housing element should consist of, but I think it's generally defined as an assessment by a community, city, of what their housing needs are and steps that they are going to take either in developing a strategy for meeting those housing needs or the strategy itself. It may be premature to define all of the strategy this first time around by the deadline that the state law has required. But this is something that this city will address itself to, and our staff, is the planning department, is beginning to pull together what we think might consist of an amendment to the general plan to qualify under the state law. And I'd like to talk about this the next time, if we can, and bring in some additional materials, perhaps, that will, for a group such as this, they might be extremely interested in the nature and scope of such an amendment.
Seems to me that is in talking to the permanent housing, and recognizing we didn't get to it, I think that is appropriate. But if you have any reactions, please let us have it. Tim?
On the subject of permanent housing, there's three things I'd like to mention. And this is longer range in many respects, but part of it's kind of answered too. Long range, there's a tract of federally owned land, some 600-700 acres lies on the east side of Murphy Canyon, which we are developing a city proposal with the assistance of San Diego Housing Corporation to submit to HUD for new community development. This large tract of land in an area suitably located in relation to existing employment, future transportation, and to having a balanced community being removed from the existing concentration, I think has a lot of potential on a long-range permanent basis. We're about to submit this proposal here currently. Point number two, the city owns some 70 acres of land adjoining the Linda Vista area, where again San Diego Housing has been collaborating with the city and developing a master plan for the development of that area, presumably by non-profit sponsors again, using various of the HUD programs in relation to it.
Where is that, Tim?
At the intersection of Wheatstone and Osler Street in Linda Vista, out on the canyon rim overlooking Tecolote. Number three, a program which is directed towards conservation and rehabilitation of existing housing, which in turn helps to bolster the supply of standard housing by not permitting more of the slide into substandard housing, is the so-called CHIRP program, which we recently had funded, which we're gearing up to getting going with. One of the first projects is in the area that Don Logan's worked with, and the other is in the Linda Vista area. And I hope that this program in future years will get increased funding and that we can make full utilization in San Diego. This program would seem to be well accepted by the community, property owners, city council, who have you, because it's in the direction of maintaining and improving the existing housing supply.
All right, I'm going to switch there. Torch already has this assignment. But we got two other communications here that were passed to me. One I've just seen this morning. They will affect the agenda for the next one or two sessions. I'll have to check with the agenda committee directly. But suggested that one there be made available to this body, and I'm going to ask Ed Butler to read it. And then Jim Oxley passed up to me a communication that he received this morning, and I think they should be read and made public as suggested.
This communication from Walter Hahn, the city manager, to George Story, who is the administrative assistant to the city council. It concerns an inquiry by a councilman concerning CIC in the dialogues, and had to do with what was said to be vituperative attacks upon the majority community in the course of the dialogue. This is Walter Hahn's response. The subject of race relations is probably one of the most critical and complex problems facing governments today. And since the human involvement is closer to the surface than the philosophical base, local governments are on the line and exercising their responsibility to identify problems and reach solutions. It would be naive for us to say that any agency is functioning at optimum level of effectiveness in the area of race relations, because we don't know what that level is.
and it would be equally naive to identify one vehicle of communicating as a panacea for the problem, or to the contrary, to condemn a communications vehicle as a contributor to the problem. The community dialogues have been highly valuable. They provide a base for the exchange of attitudes, ideas, thoughts, feelings, and understandings. They have provided a point of departure for public reporting of problems of race relations in our community, which in turn has created an increased awareness. We rarely have a communications failure. We often, however, have an understanding failure. These dialogues have focused a new awareness on the concept that perceptions are often more important than facts, especially in terms of our understanding of that phenomenon. In its present format, the dialogue has probably cycled into a position of moving toward a variance. It is examining itself now and will probably is moving in the direction of decreasing its own size by the mechanical method of splitting into special interest groupings, which will continue the process. These two will tend to build in size over a period of time, and the cycle will repeat. You mention in your inquiry so-called, quote, the 2% attacks on the white community, end quote. These alleged attacks are attitudes. They are perceptions. We must not be zoo ostriches, hoping that if we do not look at the problem, it will go away. We must identify problems, become increasingly aware of them, and through that process move towards solving them. We feel that the dialogues serve a purpose, continue to do so, and as the sessions change their format, even subtly, they will continue to be valuable communicating vehicles in the process of identifying and solving the complicated and critical problems of race relations in our community. It is one of many. You also ask for an evaluation of the effectiveness of Citizens Interracial Committee. The group of people, staff, as well as lay policy leaders, is on a tightrope. They must maintain effective relationships with multiple elements of the multifaceted total community. And since effectiveness is relative to, in this case, unclear minimums or maximums, we enter to the never-never land of value judgment. With that qualifier, CIC is effective. CIC has, in fact, accomplished the improbable task of adequate liaison and identification with its multiple publics to which it must respond. And it has moved forward in the areas of community understanding of race relations and exploration of the education, employment, housing cycle problem. At this point, we consider the expansion of CIC's area of geographic responsibility, making it a countywide organization. This will then lead us to greater funding of its effort through the cooperation of other agencies in the San Diego area, lead to increased staff and increased activity in the business of race relations throughout the minority and majority communities. We feel it important and as part of the cycle of growth and development as we face obvious problems in our community and attempt to solve them. I read this to you and brought it to you this morning once again to say to the members of the dialogue and the dialogue itself, the dialogue is a recognized vehicle of communication. We yell and scream at one another, and it's good that we do so, and I hope we'll continue. Because this is what Walter Hahn says so well. These alleged attacks are attitudes, and they are perceptions. And I bring this to you and think that to all of you I'd offer my, again, thanks, as I have in the past, and congratulations. I think we've got something going here, and I hope we continue to do it. And this, then, is the support that is being expressed by the city manager of these dialogues, and it ought to give all of us some encouragement.
Will you pass it up? We'll get into the minutes, and those who want copies, we can arrange to have copies made. If you wish copies.
We'll have another press put a quote in there on that thing, because the other thing that said against this banner dialogue, they played up a big headline.
Yeah,
no,
we're not a monologue.
Yeah. All right. would you make a note of that? And the press might want a copy directly. Can we get a copy today through the press? All right. The other communication I've not seen, I've not read at all. It was passed up to me a few minutes ago. May I just take a look at it? Jim, would you give us this, please?
Yes, I'd like to preface this, what I'm going to read with this remark. Our committee that was created by this dialogue to deal in the matter of police sergeants, particularly black sergeants, blacks may be promoted to the rank of sergeant in the police department. I have been in the consultation from time to time with the city manager. As you know, he was absent at the time that the commitment was a statement was made concerning this matter, that they would do whatever they could, that they would see that they would promote two black sergeants and give them a 90-day period to work out the particulars. And this report is the result of a 90-day investigation and inquiry into this matter, which I will read coming from the city manager's office, in particular Mr. Walter Hahn. Dear Reverend Oxley, I am writing to you on the complex and somewhat controversial subject of the requested appointment of two black police sergeants. I will try to be as clear and as candid as I possibly can. There has apparently been some commitment by my office, either implied or actual, that we will appoint two Negro police officers to the rank of sergeant without following the normal civil service examination procedures. We will in fact make no such appointment. The integrity of the civil service merit system must be maintained, and we will not take any steps which will tend to dilute or bypass this very important concept of government service in our city. I feel that this city's charter section 210, which states, and I quote, "No question in any test shall relate to race or to political or religious opinions, affiliations or service, and no appointment, transfer, layoff, promotion, reduction, suspension, or removal shall be affected or influenced by race or such opinions, affiliations, or service," end of quote. And it says that this day, which states quite clearly, this quote states quite, it states quite clearly to me that I shall not be influenced by race in connection with any promotion. And if I am so influenced, I am clearly violating the charter law of our city. Let me pursue this matter a little farther. We are clearly aware of the problems which your committee has pointed out, and we are appreciative of the time and effort you have donated to your study of this important matter. We're aware of perceptions and symbols and are concerned with them. Human relations in our community are vitally important to us, and we are involved with a great number of programs addressed to the problems of urban crisis. We, in fact, have repeatedly stated that the problem of race relations in this city is number one priority responsibility. Race relations in this city is the number one priority responsibility. And we have addressed ourselves to it. But we do this within the framework of our laws and policies, which create guidelines for serving the total community. In the specific area of police service and progress of patrolmen through the ranks, we are sincerely interested in all of our employees being promoted as they are qualified and trained for promotion. If any police officer needs special assistance in his studies for promotion, we are prepared to provide it. We hope more will take advantage of that opportunity. In the area of the police department awareness of its responsibility to human relations, I need only point to the chief's dedication to this overall subject. His established and effective communication relations division and his recent request for the addition of two community relations specialists to his immediate staff. This request was approved by this office and by the city council. I hope this letter clarifies the matter of appointing sergeants because of their color. I also hope that your committee will continue to work with us toward solving the problems you have so well outlined. We need assistance in recruiting police officers representing the minority communities of our city, and we obviously need assistance in motivating and training for advancement. is in these areas that your committee and other interested groups and agencies could be of invaluable aid. We would like to have you consider this request, and we would like to pursue it further with you. We look forward to working with you. Sincerely, Walter Hahn, Jr., City Manager. In conclusion, this includes the letter, inclusion of the statement as the committee chairman in this matter. I would like to also state one more conversation that's not in writing here, is that, no one is concerned anymore about this than I, because I think I sort of brought it up or something, or helped bring it up. After talking to Mr. Hahn, and the measure of the depth of, we can't measure the depth of a man's sincerity by our conclusions of past things that have happened in a various situation. But he recognizes the fact that there has not been adequate encouragement by the police department nor the structure as such to encourage blacks to aspire for administrative work in the police department. And he's also doing something, trying to do something about it. Now, I feel in the midst of all of our enthusiasm and our lambastings of each other, which we all know what happened in the situation. This is history. We've got to work from here forward. I feel that there's a part that we're going to have to do. We have already made some attempts in doing it, trying to get men in position where they can demand attention and consideration. We have met on a number of occasions with the black officers, most of them, and we have had long conversations with them concerning this matter. We won't relate the things that stated here unless we are forced to do so in other meetings. But I misrespond to the letter. I think that, in all fairness, and I don't think that we should run off half cocked with this thing and say that, we knew that they were lying. Some of us have said it, that it was just another substitute or smokescreen put up in order a delay in taxi. But I think that we should join hands now and try and see if we can get some men interest in police work that can pass an examination. Now, they didn't have to, the city manager didn't have to call me in and talk to me about this matter and give to me some of the facts that we were not aware of. But out of all the examinations that they've had in the past 13 years, we haven't had but one man who placed anyways near the top of consideration. Now, maybe there are some that feel that we need a charter change that will spell out that we should give preferential treatment to certain racial people who are denied. I don't know. Maybe this is another matter. But according to the charter that is stated and the portion is stated here, that the thing would be in violation of the charter. Some have said maybe we need to go out to, some other city and bring in a man who can pass an examination. I don't know, but these are some things that we have to work out. But as it stands now, of what we have now, out of the 24 black officers on the force, we do not have a man that can be appointed. Secondly, we do not have a man that will, I feel, will really, after talking to them, really commit himself to such an appointment. And I didn't think it was rumored that the chief had called him in and talked to him about it and intimidated him and so on and so on. But I have talked to them in private, and they have expressed a feeling of, let's forget about it. I also suggest that it was possible because they appointed temporary sergeants. They do this in the fire department. They appoint temporary lieutenants and captains over a period of time. I guess it's a probationary period they go through, and then the man, he has all the rights of a captain or a lieutenant, but he doesn't have the pay. Now, I don't know what the particular would be with the committee when we go back and talk to the city manager and to the police chief. I feel that we should pursue it because they have asked for our advice and guidance in this matter, and I think we should continue to pursue it. But this is the thing now, on the 6th of November, which will be Wednesday, the 90-day period that we have been laboring under will culminate. And on the 1st of November, we have the letter from the city manager expelling all doubts in our mind of what will happen. And I'm sympathetic with him.
I'm not going to shout, I'm not going to curse anybody out, because you already, your conscience is known what is right and what is wrong. And I don't think any of you are going to get it. I have three things I want to reference. One is concerning the housing before I sit down. This letter went to Mr. and Mrs. C. Johnson, effective as of 1 October 1968, the rent is being changed from $85 to $125. Also, the house is being put up for sale, and the real estate that will be handling the property, both for sale and for rental, will be Hawkins Realty at 1405 Euclid Avenue under Mr. Calvin Carter. He will be showing the house to customers interested occasionally. Payments will be due on or before the 1st of November 1968. Thank you for your cooperation. This is OSIERO, the landmark. It relates to this group. It doesn't really matter what you do about housing. This particular family will be directed not to pay the $125. When I say directed, I'm talking about a black militant organization who will tell you and your law enforcement to go to hell and shoot us and kill us. We're going to also relate to them the laws of fiction notice, not to take it, so it comes up another Kennedy. They got to have a place to stay. You can talk as long as you want about temporary permanent housing. This is a family, they have three children. We now work on a training project in Skillful Forest. We have to have a place for him to stay. His family needs a place. The house he lives in is not worth $85 a month that he's paying. He gets $110 on today from the welfare. They want 125 of 110. Somebody's figures don't appeal. Not instructed to pay that $125. Not instructed to send it out to you. Not going to do it. You can do your thing. We want to do ours. Second thing is that as black people, we don't support candidates. I'm speaking of black organizations, black organization, CORE, Soul Brothers, Black Panther Party. And we're saying to the people in our community this election is who do not to vote for us. And I want you to know those names of people who do not to vote for us. It goes through a change that looks like so. It's being passed out from 5,000 to 10,000 wives. That's how it's here. The President, George Wallace and Richard Nixon.
George, may I just interrupt there?
I'll pass out the flyer.
I would prefer that rather than the, I think. He understands the format of this.
That's all right. They'll get copies of the door. No problem. So we're impressed. And the last comment in the statement of Reverend Osborne. We have gone through the procedure by which a also went through a procedure which is quoted in here called Civil Service Section 120. We've also gone through this with Mr. Wade, the mayor, concerning culturally biased examination. We're not today in the United States looking for black people to pass the test, because the test that's established within the civil service policy is culturally biased, proven from Washington, D.C., throughout every state and every city in the United States. Somehow, I don't think you all hear very well. This has been on your view. It's been told to you before. It's passed all the way down. But now you're saying, I didn't hear it. We're going to use that procedure here. The examination that you know. You don't have to change, you don't have to change your test, you don't have to make no appointments. Now, a reward notice will go out to the black community. You've seen those, you saw it in the gangster movies where they put out contracts on people. We're going to put out a reward notice. They're going to be marked dead for any white cracker cop that molests a black kid. Now, you do your thing and we're going to do ours, but that's going to be put out on a dead man or a dead cracker who messed with black people. Now, you better sympathize them before tonight.
Referring to the communication that Reverend Oxley read, the agenda item for next time, and we won't be meeting on the 15th, we'll be meeting on the 22nd, next week and the 22nd, not the 15th, next week and the 22nd. The item that normally would be on the agenda next week, or that is what the next meeting, included the item of the police sergeants and so forth. And as much as the communication has come in here, I will try to direct the interim committee to revise their agenda or let the committee handle it in some way. I will try to have some communications with them. What I'm suggesting is that it creates a little dilemma here for the interim committee, because as you know, that was the agenda item. I will try to direct the interim committee to contact those groups who had indicated they would be here to be here when the report came. I will direct the interim committee to contact those that I know about. Jim, you might know of others. George, you might know of others, and others would plan to come next week to hear the announcements, etc. I'm trying to suggest that as chairman, it creates a dilemma. I will try to handle it in an equitable manner that does justice to all the groups involved. You will have to take my word that I will try to direct the interim committee to consider this communication.
For 22nd?
For the 8th.
On the
22nd?
Yeah.
On the 22nd instead of the 8th. All right. Susie, if you make a note of that, I'll get back with Jim or have Jim meet the part of that committee to take that item and handle it in some proper manner, Jim, in the interim committee. Next week, then, I suppose the agenda committee will decide what shall be the agenda item for next week when you meet on Wednesday. Is that correct? So everybody knows what we're doing. I'm trying to say that the interim committee has the responsibility to draw up the agenda, which it has done ahead of time, as you know. And we'll meet next week and then the 22nd. And I don't know what the agenda item then will be next week. I thought that the agenda item for the 22nd was education, am I correct? They were to come back and start education. The interim committee now has that as their responsibility to look at it and let us know next week what will be the agenda for the 22nd, etc., as Jim mentioned. Any other item that...
Would I be out of place as a member of the agenda committee to bring up the citywide election? Charter change, so we could have redistrict, so we could vote in a black candidate for our district and have true representation from our district.
You would not be out of place, but one of the items that's on the future agenda when all these things are finally resolved or move on is the charter change that's been discussed here at length and the structure now that after this interim study has been completed that will be created to do something about it. I'm suggesting that you talk to the interim committee and let them find out where it is. It's one of the items that is, so you're not out of place. The timing, I'm suggesting you discuss with the interim committee.
George Stevens made a statement here, and as a member of the dialogue and a friend of the community, which I think I am, I should not let it go unnoted, and would simply point out that under the laws of the state of California, the passing out of a brochure of the nature which I understand it to be would, of course, immediately make George and anyone passing it out or participating in the matter a conspirator. Equally liable with anyone who then committed the crime that he spoke of. I simply make that observation. I think it ought not to go unnoticed.
George,
what about this? Carol, that's wonderful. Just want you to, under your law that you already have, to do the thing so we don't have to turn around and charge you. When you don't charge yourself with what you do wrong, then we're going to charge you for it. And that's all that's being said.
Presently, George, you and I are under the same law.
No,
I just didn't want it to go unnoticed, and I wanted you to be unnoticed.
I thank you, and I appreciate that.
All right, then. The press was to get two copies, or one copy of that communication. You get that communication to the press. We'll be here next week. Next Friday, we'll be here.